today, our excellent panel will focus on two overlapping topics where the First Amendment through litigation is breaking new ground, so to speak, on these same old concepts. Our speakers, which we're delighted to have today, I will not belabor you with too much of their background and accolades, but just a little. Amy Cubbage, I think, is first up. She's a civil litigator in Louisville with Ackerson and Yon. More important, perhaps, for our purposes today, she has been litigation director and a board member for ACLU of Kentucky, involved in some hot-button cases like Twitter blocking, campaign finance, and others. Perhaps most important, however, she graduated law school with, and indeed quite well ahead of, as I understand, some distinguished guests here, including Mr. Bowman, Mr. Butler, and I believe Secretary Grayson, if he hasn't already stepped out. Oh. I was just gonna mention that Wes and Brian said he would have also finished well behind Amy, but he had to take a repeat year in business school to get out of the law school. So we're delighted to have Amy here with us. Second up on deck will be Jonathan Urich, who is litigation counsel at the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center, a friend and sometimes client of mine. We're delighted to have who have come join us today from D.C. This is not his maiden voyage to Kentucky. He served as a law clerk to Judge Thapar and Judge Sutton on the Sixth Circuit and Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court and Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court. So he really loves the law and practicing at below market wages. So thank you, John, for joining us. Third up in the hole is Bill Throw. The former Solicitor General of Virginia, who has argued cases and filed many briefs in the Supreme Court. He is currently the general counsel and a con law professor who may have taught many of you in this room at the University of Kentucky College of Law. He has published quite a lot of articles on religious liberty and free speech, and now deals with one of those two topics, campus speech, that we'll be addressing today on a very close and personal basis. Our fourth panelist is Jesse Pannuccio, the former acting Associate Attorney General of the United States. For those of you not well-versed in DC speak, that is a really big deal. It's the number three position at the U.S. Department of Justice, overseeing all of the civil litigation side of the House. So I'm sure he'll talk about some of his greatest hits during his time in the Trump administration's Justice Department, but they include the census case, all the way up to the Supreme Court, many civil rights cases, and certainly others that bear on campus speech and other free speech topics. Last but certainly not least, presiding today is Judge Nalbandian, one of our Sixth Circuit judges based in Northern Kentucky. He previously was one of the premier appellate practitioners in the Sixth Circuit with the Taft Law Firm. He also had a little political law practice that may have brought him in touch with some of you down here in Frankfurt from time to time. And during a relatively short time on the Sixth Circuit, has already distinguished himself with some excellent First Amendment decisions. So on that note, I will hand him the microphone.
Thanks, Ben.
Metaphorically.
Okay. I figured it was okay if I used the sitting mic. I'm not going to say very much. Obviously, you came to hear these distinguished panelists and not me. I just want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me. I think this is the third Kentucky State Conference that we've had. Tremendous success. I know other states have similar conferences, but I'm not sure that they are as well attended, at least on a per capita basis, as this one is. So let me just say that and congratulate you all for being here. So our panelists are going to talk today about some very interesting developments in the First Amendment. Obviously, social media, campus speech, I think, and some other speeches that may be a deregulatory tool or weaponizing it. I'm not sure that we're going to get into whether free speech is literally killing us. I think you have to consult a recent New York Times editorial if you want that. I'm serious. I think it was last week. Go ahead and look it up. I just, you know, these are hard cases, and they're interesting, but we all know the old adage that hard cases make bad law. Some, of course, say that bad law makes hard cases, and of course, my colleagues at my old law firm like to tell me that bad judges make bad law. So with that, I want to thank the panel for being here and tell them that I fully expect them, in addition to updating us on where we are with the First Amendment, to speculate wildly about what the future is going to hold. So with that, I think Amy Cubbage is our first speaker.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I've been joking, I'm your cannon fodder for the afternoon. Hopefully we can keep it entertaining. I know all of us feel a little daunted by coming on after the last panel, but hopefully we will provide some good information for you and a little bit of entertainment value along the way. It's interesting, I wasn't planning to talk about the Janus case, but since it was thrown out there, since I figure most people here are members of the Kentucky Bar Association, since we are a unified or mandatory bar, just know that topic is hot in bar regulation circles. It's one that is actually very tightly monitored at your mandatory bar association because of the implications. I know historically the Kentucky Bar Association has tried to be very careful about not stepping over the line with any kind of political speech since they are a mandatory bar, and they have given refunds of certain percentages of bar dues when anybody acting on behalf of the Bar Association has stepped over the line. So that's a hot topic. There is quite a bit of litigation that's starting to pop up around the nation with respect to bar associations. Please don't spend our bar dues yet on that. Hopefully we can, some of that can shake out before we see what happens. I personally, having been on the board of the Bar Association for the past 6 years, see value in our mandatory bar and in the Bar Association, in particular, having some role in attorney discipline in particular. But that is a very big topic since Janus came up in our introduction. Just thought I would throw that one out there. I think I'm supposed to kick us off talking both a little bit about social media and school speech. Social media, I know we know that that's ubiquitous. I speak a lot about social media, just in the nuts and bolts. Not a lot about the First Amendment implications, particularly because until government officials were using social media quite a bit, there weren't a lot of First Amendment implications, even though you had a lot of people on all sides of political issues or possibly non-political issues who felt like it was a First Amendment violation when they got kicked off of a platform for violation of terms of services. So far, it is uniformly being held that that's obviously private speech, and it is speech being facilitated by private companies who have a right to set their own terms of service. So no one really has a cause of action when you are banned from a platform such as Facebook or Twitter, even if you feel like it's a content-based restriction. You don't have a right to force someone else to facilitate your speech. That's a private company. But that's starting to, there's a couple of twists I'd like to throw out there. First is, of course, what happens when public officials are using these private modes of speech to get their speech out there. Whether it's as a private citizen when they're running for office or as an official Twitter account, like we see with President Trump or with Governor Bevin, what does that mean for the platform? Does the platform have any responsibilities itself in having separate rules for public officials? I'd say probably not, but we are starting to have some cases coming up. I know we'll talk probably more specifically with later speakers about a few courts have held that President Trump could not block Twitter followers since he has in essence turned that into a public forum. And he has to allow people both to see his tweets and to interact with his tweets. We actually have a contrary opinion so far that has come down in Kentucky. Judge Van Tatenhove held that it was essentially a non-public forum, and that Governor Bevin could block at will, on not for content-based restrictions, but could impose some essentially time, place, and manner sorts of restrictions on his social media feed. So that's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. I won't get too much into the weeds of the different formats of social media, but that can obviously, if we're talking about a difference between a Facebook and a Twitter block, if you block on Facebook, they can still at least see your speech. On Twitter, typically, unless you log out of the platform, you can't. So there are some interesting quirks depending on the platform you're talking about. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that litigation as we turn to a media where there is, fair or not, less trust in traditional media platforms, and more of us get the majority of our news from social media. I mean, Facebook, I think the statistic was even 6 or 7 years ago, there were over 1 billion people on Facebook. I think it's even more than that now. So that is the main source of news. So it segueing into my other thought about social media, that then brings up the issue of these are private companies. Now, so what responsibilities do they have, and what responsibility does the government have, perhaps, to start regulating these very large companies that have a very large percent of the media market, particularly with respect to political speech, as perhaps a public utility, getting back to the idea that if Facebook wants to kick off the Proud Boys for violation of terms of service, should they have a cause of action because that functionally silences their speech altogether? I don't know that we would ever get to that point. Obviously, when we talked about public goods such as electricity or water, we have seen government intervention over the course of our state and of our nation, where we do have either public ownership or substantial public regulation because there's a public good there. I don't know that we could ever do that with a speech outlet because of the peculiar First Amendment concerns that you would have there. But it does raise the question of, are things like Facebook and Twitter becoming so important to our society that there is going to be some sort of push or need for government regulation, and how could that ever be accomplished in light of the First Amendment and, of course, the private companies' rights to run their businesses as they see fit, which has a free association right under the First Amendment. So there's no easy answers there. I'm sure that the rest of the panelists will have some probably deeper thoughts than I do about the social media conundrum. But I think we see after the 2016 election how important social media was. It's going to be even bigger in 2020. It's very big in our governor's race and all of our constitutional races in 2019. So these are going to be important, difficult questions. Now, as far as school speech, I'm going to admit that's not my big bailiwick as far as the work I do. I know there seems to be a lot of discussion or furor over the PC police and PC mania and things have gone too far. What I'm hearing on the ground is, though there are some obvious hotspots and tension with things like Title IX compliance and preventing religious discrimination, that it's really not as big a deal as the media would have you think it's a big deal. You may be hearing different from some of my colleagues on there, but where we really seem to be having more difficulty, at least from the civil libertarian aspect, has been restrictions that are starting to creep in on the academic freedom side in both ways, from legislatures who may not be happy with certain things that are taught, wanting to bring in things like BDS bans on professors who may be espousing BDS restrictions against Israel, or the recent letter that was sent from the Department of Education aimed at the UNC and Duke collaborative on Middle East studies that seemed to be spurned by an unhappiness with the fact that it was seen as too pro-Islam. So a content-based kind of concern was sent from the Department of Education. So you're starting to see really more of the substantive concerns, not so much on the student speech side, though those issues are real, and in an increasingly pluralistic society, it's going to be harder to balance those concerns between disparate types of students, though I think both the ACLU and the Federalist Society would see a benefit in having as robust of speech as possible within obvious limits of just general decency and not having straight up warfare break out within the Brandenburg Standard. But really more of the concerns I'm seeing from the universities are more on the back end and other restrictions of speech, of academic speech from the professor side. So I think I'll go ahead and stop and pass it off to our next speaker. When all of us have spoken, Judge Nobandian may have a question or two now, but then we will have some discussion between the panelists and open it up for questions.
Great, thank you, Amy. I think we'll just go to, I'm intrigued by the way that Facebook as water or maybe electricity, I'm not sure about water, although maybe Snapchat is more of a water necessity. Anyway, we'll go to John Urich now.
Thanks, Judge, and thanks to both the national and local Federalist Society chapters for having me here at this conference. It's really cool to be back in Kentucky. And while I was clerking for Judge Thapar, I never did make it down to Frankfurt, so it's really a great honor to be in this gorgeous state house and this equally gorgeous chamber. So thanks to the General Assembly and to the House of Representatives for having us here. Just one quick disclaimer before I jump into my substantive remarks. So I do amicus work for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, represent the business community at large. But my remarks here today are purely my own personal views. They don't necessarily reflect that of the chamber as a whole, although I will try to give you the perspective of the business community and sort of what's on the business community's mind in the courts. So as Ben said, there's lots of talk and controversy over the weaponization of the First Amendment. And as he suggested, you know, that's a good thing. I mean, the First Amendment is about free speech and about our constitutional rights, and we should absolutely be weaponizing it, or, you know, I don't know why that's a pejorative term, but we should be using it to vindicate our constitutional rights when the government oversteps. And so, but that said, the First Amendment protects some things and covers some things and doesn't cover other things. And so I want to talk a little bit about what, from my perspective and the business community's perspective, the First Amendment can do and how it can be a deregulatory tool in some contexts and what it can't do. And so on the side of what it can do, when it comes to commercial speech, it can very much be a powerful deregulatory tool. And we're seeing with increasing frequency, governments are trying to achieve their regulatory and public policy objectives by co-opting business commercial speech with government messages to achieve political aims, rather than just go out and use their own government speech and promote their own messages on policies that matter to them. They're co-opting businesses to carry that message for them. And so we can use the First Amendment to push back against these compelled messages in certain contexts. Unfortunately, as probably you all know, commercial speech under current Supreme Court doctrine sort of has a second class status. And without getting too doctrinally in the weeds, under a case called Central Hudson, restrictions on commercial speech only get intermediate scrutiny. And under a case called Zouderer, compelled commercial disclosures get even sort of a lesser standard of review. And so for that reason, it can be hard sometimes to push back under the First Amendment. Now, I think, and under my own personal views, I think Justice Thomas has the right approach to commercial speech. There's, you know, under the Supreme Court's modern jurisprudence, we don't make up new exceptions to the First Amendment. It's got to be a historically grounded, longstanding exception to the First Amendment exception to the First Amendment's protections to be accepted. And there is no historical exception. Justice Thomas has documented this in a number of really outstanding separate opinions. There's really no historical basis for giving commercial speech second-class status. But that said, that's not the current state of the law. And but maybe we are moving a little bit in the right direction. So in a really important case called NIFLA from, I believe, two terms ago, there are some really positive developments on the commercial speech side. So first of all, the court rejected a so-called professional speech or occupational speech sort of exception to the First Amendment and basically just said, look, the normal rules for commercial speech apply. There's no sort of additional secondary status for speech in a so-called professional context, whatever that might mean. And the court explicitly said, we're not even sure what that means in the first place, but there's no sort of general exception for professional speech. And the court also said that, elaborate a little bit on the Zouderer framework. So what Zouderer says is that compelled disclosure requirements are okay if they involve purely factual and non-controversial information about, and a couple other criteria too, about the terms that the product or service is being offered, and they have to be related to preventing consumer deception. Now that's at least the way I read Zouderer. As I'm going to get to, there's a big debate going on about whether that's really what Zouderer requires or not. And so the second important piece of NIFLA, there's a bunch of other important pieces of NIFLA, but for my purposes, the second important piece of NIFLA is the court said that even a literally true statement like California offers free or reduced price abortions, that can fail the purely factual and non-controversial test. So maybe it's purely factual information, but it wasn't non-controversial because it had to do with abortion. So those two pieces of Zouderer do independent work. It has to, the statement to be acceptable as a compelled disclosure has to be both purely factual and non-controversial. And so the question now after NIFLA is whether Zouderer's reduced standard for these compelled disclosures, what does it cover? Does it apply only to, sort of in the context of disclosures needed to prevent consumer deception, or does it apply in a broader context? And does it allow compelled disclosures that are literally true, but perhaps misleading or give an incomplete picture or just straight up misleading? And so I can give you a few examples of what I mean in this context of cases that we are either considering filing amicus briefs in or have been involved in the past. So two of these actually come out of the Ninth Circuit. There's a case that's been up and down from the Ninth Circuit and up and down to the Supreme Court, at least at the cert stage, a couple times, called CTIA versus Berkeley, California. And it involves some warnings that the city of Berkeley required cell phone companies to issue about the risk of radio frequency radiation. Basically, the disclosure said you have to disclose that carrying around your cell phone technically might expose you to more radio frequency radiation than like the FCC's guidelines. Even though the FCC itself says cell phones are safe and there's basically no research, no scientific research, or certainly no scientific consensus that cell phones expose you to a dangerous amount of radiation. And so there's litigation pushing back there that this is, maybe literally true about the FCC's guidelines, but very misleading and definitely not non-controversial. And so the Supreme Court GVR'd that case. The Ninth Circuit upheld that compelled disclosure requirement. The Supreme Court GVR'd that case after NIFLA, went back down to the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit upheld it again and said no problem. And importantly, the Ninth Circuit took a very broad reading of Zouderer and said it is absolutely not limited to the consumer deception context. And it also satisfies Zouderer as long as the required statement is literally true. That's it. As long as it's a literally true factual statement, that's it. The court actually said NIFLA was about abortion. Like, that's it. And So there's now another cert petition at the Supreme Court now, was just filed like 5 days ago, about whether that's really what Zouderer means, especially after NIFLA. And so another case, an en banc Ninth Circuit case that actually CTIA 2 relied on, is American Beverage Association versus San Francisco. So San Francisco required some warnings about sugary drinks, and only sugary drinks, not candy or anything else, just sugary drinks, that required sugary drinks and their sellers to say, basically, consuming sugary drinks can cause diabetes and obesity, just like that. And that was challenged as being misleading and incomplete because it's really not, sugary beverages are technically safe according to the FDA, and it's really the amount you consume. That's really the issue, combined with other things like how active you are and stuff, right? So they challenged, the American Beverage Association challenged that requirement as misleading. And it also, the law also required the labels to devote like at least 20% to the warning. And so we filed an amicus brief in that case supporting the beverage companies, and the Ninth Circuit in an en banc decision struck it down, but on sort of very narrow grounds about the size of the warning and how there wasn't enough evidence in the record to support that particular size of the warning, and maybe 10% of the label was okay, was sufficient to achieve what the government is trying to achieve. But again, they took a very broad understanding of Zouderer, and so in that sense, it may not have been a win for the business community. And then there's a pending case in the DC Circuit, Merck and some drug companies versus the Health and Human Services Department, challenging the Trump administration's new drug price disclosure rule for direct-to-consumer TV advertisements about prescription drugs. And so under this disclosure requirement, every direct-to-consumer TV ad has to disclose, quote, the list price of a drug. But what does that mean? The list price is actually the price that wholesalers pay for the drug. That does not include, this does not take account of rebates, and certainly not of private insurance or government insurance that most people have. So there's really almost no relationship between the price that is required to be disclosed and what the vast majority of consumers actually pay for a prescription drug. So there's an ongoing challenge there that's misleading and thus violates the First Amendment. The district court judge actually kicked it on statutory grounds. There's a big fight about whether the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services can actually do this, and they won on that ground, but they're gonna press, the challenger's gonna continue to press the First Amendment argument at the DC Circuit. So stay tuned on that. The CTIA cert petition could get granted, and then maybe we'll get some more guidance from the Supreme Court on what Zouderer means and what really the First Amendment can offer as a deregulatory tool in the commercial speech context. And briefly, what can't the First Amendment do, though, from the business community's perspective? And Amy basically hinted exactly what I'm gonna cover, which is that the First Amendment only applies to the government. So as much as I am personally troubled, and a lot of us may be troubled by alleged content and viewpoint-based discrimination by social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Google and YouTube, unfortunately that's, in our view, at least in my personal view, not a problem that the First Amendment can solve, because it just doesn't apply to private entities. And so we filed, and the Supreme Court just this past term confirmed that in a case, at least we think it confirmed that in a case called Manhattan Community Access versus Halleck, which involved a public access channel. So same sort of idea, public access channel accepts content from average people, members of the public. And the Supreme Court there said, a private company operating a public forum does not transform you into a state actor. There were a bunch of other holdings too, but that was a core one for our purposes today, that operating a public forum does not automatically make you a state actor. And so we also filed an amicus brief supporting Google in PragerU's suit against Google because of alleged discrimination by viewpoint-based discrimination by YouTube, making the same argument. And quite the contrary, actually, not only can the First Amendment solve this problem, but also, as Amy hinted, I think it actually prevents remedies of this sort. So there's lots of Supreme Court cases saying that you know platforms and content providers have editorial control over their own content. You can't make a newspaper carry both sides of a topic. And as Justice Kavanaugh, when he was a judge on the DC Circuit, wrote an opinion about net neutrality, basically saying, in his view, imposing net neutrality on ISPs may actually violate the First Amendment by depriving the ISPs of sort of their editorial control over the content that they provide. So for that reason, I think there's really limits. So I think net neutrality may have constitutional problems for that reason. Also, hinging, this is a little more complicated, but hinging CDA immunity on the lack of viewpoint discrimination may also run into the exact sort of same constitutional problems. I know there's a lot of proposals out there, or at least one particular proposal out there to hinge CDA 230 immunity on content neutrality. And I think that has serious constitutional problems as well. So that.
Great. Thanks, John.
Sure.
First, thanks for the opportunity to present today. A couple of housekeeping matters at the start. First, although my job is general counsel at the University of Kentucky, I'm speaking today in my personal capacity. Nothing I say should be construed as the views of the University of Kentucky. However, if I say something that is particularly brilliant, those are the views of my boss, Eli Capiluto. If I say something that's particularly stupid, those are the views of the head football coach for the University of Arkansas that we're going to beat on Saturday. I want to address three questions. First, why do we have a so-called campus free speech crisis? Second, what's sort of the short-term solution to that? And third, what is the long-term solution? The first question, why do we have a campus free speech crisis? I think the answer is collapse, concentration, and coddling. Now, by collapse of the constitutional consensus. There are many folks on the left and increasingly on the right who no longer believe in the self-evident truths of free speech, religious liberty, due process, or equal protection. Instead of a union conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all are created equal, we are dividing into a series of tribes who, quite frankly, fear freedom and embrace intersectionality. Second, concentration. A concentration of pluralism, which Amy sort of alluded to. Outside of academia, we live in bubbles. Our communities are either solidly red or solidly blue. Our neighborhoods consist of people who have incomes very similar to ours. And our circle of friends is, quite frankly, predominantly either people of faith or citizens of the secular. We don't mix. Yet on my campus, we have students from every single one of Kentucky's 120 counties, every state in the union, and every continent. 25% of the students on my campus come from families with incomes of less than $25,000 a year. That's the federal poverty line for a family of four. Those kids go to school with the sons and daughters of multimillionaires. If you walk across my campus, you're going to see gay pride t-shirts. You're also going to see religious garb. And in a couple of instances, they're going to be worn by the same person. The potential for conflict is absolutely everywhere. And finally, coddling. Coddling of the American Mind, the book by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. Haidt and Lukianoff argue we have an entire generation that's been taught that everyone is emotionally fragile. What doesn't kill you will only make you weaker. Feelings are more important than facts, and the world is divided into good and evil. People are either for you or against you. Now, quite frankly, people who endorse this paradigm fear any sort of discussion that might question any of their values or their policy preferences. They're not going to want a reasoned debate. So you have people who don't want a reasoned debate with people from a huge variety of different backgrounds in a society that increasingly doesn't believe in our constitutional values. So what's the short-term reaction? Well, the short-term reaction is to look to Hamilton, particularly Federalist 78. The judiciary must ensure that the will of the people, as expressed in the words of the Constitution, prevails over the will of the people's agents, the actions of elected officials, or in my case, university administrators. The judiciary so far has done its duty. The legacy of the Roberts Court is not same-sex marriage, but the expansion of freedom of speech and religious liberty. The court has said on three separate occasions that hate speech is not constitutionally protected. Despite that, many folks on my campus, in fact, probably a majority, continue to think that there is a hate speech exception to the First Amendment, but it is, in fact, constitutionally protected. The court has also rejected compelled speech, the Janus or the NIFLA case that we've already talked about, and forced subsidy of speech, Janus. Those decisions have major implications for higher ed, and in the materials for the CLE, there's an article from the University of Dayton law review called Embracing Constitutionalism that discusses this in greater detail. The Sixth Circuit has also followed suit with some path-breaking decisions concerning open space on campus. McGlone versus Bell, the heckler's veto, Bible believers versus City of Dearborn, Michigan, probably the strongest heckler's veto decision in the country. And most recently, decisions on bias incident response teams at the University of Michigan. So the courts are going to continue to step in and to do what they need to do to preserve the constitutional order. I would also add, since we are in the House chamber, that legislatures increasingly are doing something similar. This past session, the Kentucky General Assembly passed the Campus Free Speech Act, which expanded upon legislation already passed in 2017 that essentially codifies and reinforces First Amendment values on our campus. But that's only a short-term solution. We only will have judges who are pro-First Amendment as long as we keep appointing judges who are pro-First Amendment. We only will have legislation that favors the First Amendment as long as we have legislative majorities that feel that way. So what's the long-term solution? Ultimately, I think we have to look to Abraham Lincoln. The mystic chords of memory must be touched by the better angels of our nature. In other words, if a nation founded on an idea, as ours was, is to long endure, there must be a rebirth of that idea in each generation. We need to restore the constitutional consensus with the students who are currently on our college campuses. Then and only then will we be able to prevail. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Phil. Jesse.
Okay, so that makes me the last speaker on the last panel of the day. So everybody put down your phones. Just give me 10 more minutes. We're going to be talking about social media. There's nothing on Twitter that will be more exciting than this. So thanks to the Federalist Society. I guess I need to give some kind of disclaimer too, but there's no one I want to attribute these remarks to, and I won't attribute them to myself either. So they're just remarks, and if they're good, fine, and if not, you know, that's all right too. So I've prepared some remarks because I'm not quite out of the Justice Department habit of being very careful, you know, and have scripted remarks, but so bear with me. So, you know, if you look at the brochure, the description of this panel is fairly broad. I chose to read it as, what are some modern trends in free speech, especially in the age of social media? I think there are three issues worth noting here. The first I would describe as, historically speaking, not a very big deal. The second I would describe as possibly a big deal. We'll have to see how it plays out. And then the third issue I'm going to discuss today, I would describe as a very big deal. So let's turn to the first issue, the one that I think is not a big deal from a First Amendment perspective. The internet and social media have us teeming with political speech and really all kinds of speech. And the smartphones we all carry around ensure this speech flows in a near constant stream of what I would charitably call editorial incontinence. So we have new ways of communicating and society is adjusting to them, and accordingly, so are our politics. That is to say, our politics have moved into the social media age. But that is nothing new. Our politics have always adapted to new forms of mass communication. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, newsboys with cries of extra, extra, hawked morning and evening newspapers of the yellow press, which teemed with politics and sensationalism. When radio emerged, Calvin Coolidge in 1923 took to the airwaves to address Americans, and then regularly did so thereafter, and Franklin Roosevelt famously gave his fireside chats over the radio. When television emerged, Nixon and Kennedy famously had the first televised presidential debate, forever changing how politicians and presidential candidates communicate with the American public. So politics follows an expressive medium as it emerges, and the medium shapes politics, and politics often shapes the medium. None of this is new, and it's not necessarily bad. Social media has probably democratized political discourse in substantial and beneficial ways. Now, of course, some of this flood of political speech over social media is ill-considered, hot-tempered, derogatory, and regrettable. Some people, therefore, claim social media is coarsening our politics. But coarse political speech is nothing new for Americans. From our very founding, we have had a people who boil over with sharp political speech. If you don't believe me, go read the issues of Ben Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac. you will find plenty of pointed and sharp political rhetoric. As law professor from Yale, Akilah Maher, aptly described the founding era speech in America, he said the following: "The Constitution was born in a land awash with speech and through a process that teemed with talk of the freest sort, including lots of talk harshly critical of existing officials and institutions. In an extraordinary effervescence of accusations, addresses, analysis, arguments, books, cartoons, conversations, debates, disquisitions, and on, writings of every sort, Americans in the enactment process itself exercised and exemplified an amazingly vigorous form of expression." So that cacophonous tumult of political speech has persisted ever since. Go read the articles from the yellow press of the early 20th century, which Theodore Roosevelt complained, quote, "habitually and continually, and as a matter of business, practice every form of mendacity known to man, from suppression of the truth and the suggestion of the false to the lie direct." So for those looking for a modern translation, Teddy Roosevelt was saying, fake news. Or go and look at any presidential campaign and see what the warring factions said about each other. As early as 1800, the Jefferson camp called Adams a hideous, hermaphroditical character which has neither the force or firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. Adams, for his part, was no better. He called his rival Hamilton the bastard brat of a Scotch peddler. Andrew Jackson's mother was called the common prostitute. Franklin Pierce in 1855 was called the pimp of the White House. Lincoln was insulted as sooty and scoundrelly and compared to the person who empties privies in the evening. There was, in short, never an era of good feelings in America, in American politics. So while I don't endorse the coarseness reflected in our social media politics, I think it is, from a historical standpoint, not a very big deal. Let me turn then to the second issue surrounding the First Amendment in the age of social media. And that is, how should we apply First Amendment doctrines to these new technologies? This issue is the one I would identify as maybe a big deal for free speech. I say maybe a big deal because it depends on how courts and legislatures ultimately deal with the challenges and new questions that emerge. The country has grappled with the interplay of emerging technologies and First Amendment principles before. Those who are law students may be coming to these chapters in their constitutional law class, and those who are lawyers may remember that when television and radio emerged and we had spectrum licensing, that resulted in debates over the scarcity doctrine and the so-called fairness doctrine. And there's a 1969 Supreme Court case called Red Lion versus FEC. Then when cable technology came about and changed the facts on the ground, we had those debates again. And we had a 1994 case of Turner Broadcasting versus FCC raising some of the debates, same issues and debates. Now we have the internet and social media, and these new technologies are again raising new questions to deal with the new facts. I think two such questions have generated buzz and debate lately. The first question is, when government officials take to social media on private accounts, what are the First Amendment implications for those who want to interact with them there and for the officials themselves? These questions are raised by the lawsuit against President Trump over his blocking certain Twitter accounts from the @RealDonaldTrump Twitter handle. The Second Circuit, I think, breezily decided the case with the following logic. The president tweets official statements from his own personal account, therefore the account is a public forum, and therefore his blocking users is viewpoint discrimination that violates the First Amendment. To my mind, the Second Circuit sidestepped some critical questions. For example, it did not seriously engage with the nature of Twitter and how its parameters fit within case law on how a forum can become public, semi-public, or private. Twitter is not public property. It is a private property that its owner has established with certain rules of engagement. By its owner, I mean the owners of Twitter, not the account holder of the handle. The Second Circuit noted specifically in footnote 2, use of the platform is governed by terms of service which users agree to when they use the platform. End quote, a Twitter user cannot choose to have an account that has a subset of these features. For example, and again I'm quoting the Second Circuit, a user cannot obtain from Twitter an account that prohibits certain other users from blocking them. So, yet just such an account is exactly what some users have now obtained via a federal court injunction that the Second Circuit has upheld. The Second Circuit does not analyze at all. You will not find one word of analysis about how these facts should affect the forum analysis. It also does not analyze what it means for free speech rights of Twitter's owners to have their platform rules co-opted and changed by federal district courts who issue these types of injunctions. The Second Circuit also failed to seriously analyze how its holding should apply in other areas. So the court found that because the president uses his private Twitter account, quote, as a channel for communicating and interacting with the public about his administration, he cannot engage in any viewpoint discrimination. But if that's true, then think about this. When the president holds a press conference in the White House briefing room or on the South Lawn of the White House, is he permitted to pick and choose which reporters he will answer and which questions he will ignore? Or is that also impermissible viewpoint discrimination? Because, of course, those press conferences are a channel for communicating and interacting with the public about his administration. Or, as the government points out in its petition for rehearing, if the president, as many have in the past, holds a rally or a press conference on his private ranch or private property, can the president make choices about who's admitted onto that property or not? Or is that impermissible viewpoint discrimination? The Second Circuit deals with none of these rather tricky questions. So these are interesting and perhaps difficult questions, and depending on how the Supreme Court ultimately answers them, they could be a big deal. The second possibly big question about the interaction of social media and the First Amendment is over, as you've already heard, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which states, quote, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In other words, social media companies are protected from defamation actions and other laws that sometimes create constitutionally and permissibly liability for speech. This issue is one that Senator Hawley and others are raising, and the point that those folks are making is that social media companies are not necessarily acting anymore like neutral platform providers. They are curating content, favoring content, and censoring content. That makes them look more like traditional publishers who, since the founding, could be subject to liability for what they publish. On the other hand, some people see Section 230 immunity as an important bulwark for free speech for the masses, noting that the fairness doctrine for networks did not lead to balanced speech. It simply led to less speech and an avoidance by the networks of controversial speech. So again, these questions are difficult, but from a historical perspective, we have usually been able to fold them in to existing First Amendment principles. And with that, I think we'll be able to do that again. That is, if we have a historic commitment to free speech. And this brings me to my third and final point. And this one has nothing to do with social media, or more accurately, social media has perhaps made it more visible, but is not responsible for it. The country has always struggled with balancing free speech rights against the desire to suppress unpopular speech. Historically, the First Amendment has always won. Take, for example, the Sedition Acts of 1798 or 1918. They were relatively short-lived, and they are taught in law school classes and, frankly, grade school classes as something to be derided and not consistent with our core constitutional values. Today, I think attitudes are changing towards speech suppression. In particular, even while social media has created a speech explosion among the masses, I think the elites of our society are losing their reverence for and their traditional position as defenders of free speech. And there are two places I think this is most evident. One is in the traditional media, and the second is at our colleges and universities, among the academy and professors. Let me focus briefly on the academy, because that's campus free speech is an issue we spent a lot of time in my office at DOJ. What's going on in the college campus is, by this point, fairly well documented, from speech codes to permit requirements to heckler's vetoes. There is, I think, as Bill said, a free speech crisis on campus. The violent events at Middlebury in 2017 are a good example, but they are far from the only example. Just this morning, many of you probably missed this, hecklers shouted down and prevented from speaking the acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security at Georgetown University, and he had to leave the stage. But I should be clear that the shutdowns and shoutdowns of high-profile speakers, they make the headlines, but the heckler's veto is by no means limited to those high-profile examples. I think it pervades the daily life of academic inquiry and debate carried out against students and faculty who express ideas out of sync with the predominant viewpoint on campus. The more this kind of speech suppression happens, the more regularized it seems, the more is it encouraged, the more students think it's a good idea. And you can look at the Gallup polling on this. It's very alarming. If you take the Gallup poll from 2017, 49% of students favor speech codes. 30% believe colleges should be able to ban expression of political views that are upsetting or offensive. The most telling statistic is that 60% of students agree with the following statement. The climate on my campus prevents some people from saying things they believe because others might find them offensive. Now, in other words, a clear majority of students believe that the climate at their school suppresses the expression of ideas. Reflect upon, I think as Bill did, the seriousness of that for a moment. These are the institutions that are supposed to encourage debate. What has happened to our institutions of higher learning? And that brings me to my final point. What I've just described, the speech codes and the heckler's veto, are symptoms of this free speech crisis. They are not the cause. The root cause of the crisis, I think, is that we no longer have broad agreement on what a university is all about. When Thomas Jefferson founded UVA, he would commit in a letter of 1820, the institution would be based on the illimitable freedom of the human mind, and its residents would not be afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor tolerate any error, so long as reason is left to combat it. And that's the key phrase, so long as reason is left to combat it. This was the traditional view of the university, that reason and debate are available to combat any speech you disagree with. It was the bond shared by scholars and students alike, and it was the defining purpose of higher education. I think in place of this spirit of free inquiry, we now have a focus on feelings, that feelings and not reason should govern what's happening on a college campus. The necessary implication is that any idea or speech that contradicts the current majority beliefs or feelings is offensive, hurtful, and valueless, and properly can be silenced. Now, the great danger in this is that, and why American society at large should be deeply concerned, is that this is the generation that we are educating to go be statesmen and leaders and politicians. And if they don't have, and I think Bill pointed this out, a core respect for our First Amendment values, and they're deeply ingrained, then all of those questions I alluded to earlier about how will First Amendment doctrine be folded into social media, how will these new cases emerge, all of that could change radically. And that is why I say I think this third issue of the three that I brought up today is the biggest deal, the most alarming, and the most concerning. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jesse, and let's give our panelists a hand for their opening presentations. I typically will give the panelists a chance if something struck them while the others were talking that they want to say. Amy, do you have is there something you want to?
I think the NIFLA line of cases are going to be important. I'm glad those were brought up. And I think, I will just, as full disclosure, I filed, I guess in the past 2 weeks, a cert petition on a NIFLA case, but it actually has to do with abortion. So it is not going to probably figure out any of those parameters beyond abortion of how NIFLA and Zotter are going to apply to commercial speech. And I do think the commercial speech one is an important one, and you're seeing it in all kinds of contexts. We had the recent, I think it was Arkansas, had a statute that was not allowing plant-based food alternatives to be called meat. Or almond milk couldn't be referred to as milk, and it was premised on this concept of that's a disclosure requirement that is misleading to the public. When I'm not a fan of almond milk, but I know it's really not from a mammal. It's not what is scientifically known as milk. There's no real disclosure issue there. So I think that is a very interesting topic that is going to be confronted in the Central Hudson framework for and some of the other cases for commercial speech. We could see fall by the wayside. It should be interesting.
No, I agree 100%. I think, this is just another example of both the consensus about speech, I think, breaking down, as well as the government seeing speech restrictions or compelled disclosures as sort of an attractive tool to promote their message rather than go out there and actually pound the pavement and do the work of government speech and convince people that the government's policies are just like we all in the marketplace of ideas have to convince people that our ideas are meritorious and are tested by reason and all the things that we're talking about. We all have to do that, but the government wants to co-opt private people's platforms and messages and credibility to promote their message rather than doing the own hard, their own hard work of convincing the public. So I think we're it's definitely going to be a lot more litigation, I think, on this front for sure.
I talked mostly about campus speech, but I do want to hit the technology issue. Frequently, those of us who favor an originalist interpretive mode are told, well, the framers could never envisioned this, so you know we have to come up with new law and new principles for that. And I think that's actually wrong, because I think the principles are timeless even if the technology has changed. If you ask the framing generation, hey, can the government look at the correspondence between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, which they would write letters and then it would take like a month to get from Charlottesville to Boston or vice versa, you know, the answer would have been emphatically, absolutely not. Well, that also means that the government can't look at their private telegraphs, which would have been sent in, had they lived, in the 1840s. It could not listen into their telephone calls in the 1870s, and it could not read their emails in the 21st century. The principles are timeless, and just as we could not force a presidential candidate having a press conference on his front porch in 1896, I think McKinley was the first person to do that, to call on this reporter, or to call on all reporters rather than just one or two, I'm not sure that we can force the president or the governor or anybody else to let people use his personal Twitter account or his personal Facebook account. I think the principles are there. We just need to apply them to the new technology.
Let me ask you this, though. So if famous Kentuckian once wrote that sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? That the best counter for bad speech, I suppose, is to get your own good speech out there. Why, though, I mean, isn't that just a horse and buggy view of the First Amendment, though? I mean, why, with the way that false speech or fake news or whatever it is can get disseminated so quickly, why shouldn't we have some kind of regulation that maybe we didn't have before? Go ahead.
Sure. So while I do have faith, I'll answer the question this way. So while I have faith that the marketplace of ideas can do some work to push back on this, the way I think of the First Amendment is that it's really more about suspicion of the government than about that the marketplace of ideas is so amazing. And it is important and amazing, but I think what the First Amendment is really about is that we'd rather have the marketplace of ideas work this out than have the government referee this. That there's the bigger danger, while the marketplace of ideas can fail and there can be fake news and all these other things, that the bigger risk, the bigger threat is the government discriminating among viewpoints, picking winners and losers, and trying to steer the debate in its preferred way, rather than deal with and accept the messy process and flawed process of the public square. So I take a more libertarian approach to the First Amendment, where it's not that, you know, the marketplace of ideas is so perfect, it's that the government is worse.
I think I would agree with that, and I think that's kind of where I come down. There's obviously issues inherent in the new technology. It doesn't mean that we have to throw out the First Amendment, but I think there is going to be some tension as we work those issues out, because it's obviously not perfect. But I tend to think that, yes, if the government comes in and tries, you know, I threw out the public utility concept, I think that's a horrible idea personally. But I think that government interventions into those are perhaps going to be even less perfect than what we have now. And I am inherently suspicious of those as well.
I'll just add, I mean, I think the interesting question, at least if we're talking about the debate about Section 230, is what's the government intervention? Is the government intervention the original intervention of protecting folks from liability that has existed since the founding, or is the intervention now getting rid of that? And you know, that's a sort of a classic law school hypothetical, but, you know, we have this baseline of First Amendment. It says this much speech is free, and then the rest of it you can be sued for and liable for. And then we have statutory law on top of that that says, no, here's a group of people that can't be liable for that. So, you know, I don't know the right answer to that question necessarily, but it just depends where you start from, I think, where you're going to answer that question.
I think ultimately the free market is far from perfect. However, the free market is closer to perfect than leaving it to any one group of individuals, whether they be government officials or private officials or university professors or whatever. Certainly, fraud is not constitutionally protected, never has been, nor is defamation. But there's been an awful lot of sensationalist rhetoric in newspapers for as long as we've had a republic, and we have done just fine. And the fact that it can now be spread quite easily with Twitter or fake news or whatever we're calling it this week is really, I think, irrelevant.
Do we have any audience questions? I want to open this up before we wrap up.
So what do you say to the argument of, instead of like making Facebook a public utility, as to breaking them up, using the antitrust hammer, so that the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the Googles of the world don't have to make a speech code for the entire planet, but, you know, having many other different competitors and breaking up these monolithic entities that they've become?
I'll jump in first, since I'm the one who threw that out there. I think that's probably the logical way that it's going to go. I know there are actually presidential candidates who have made those threats, but then I wonder if would those threats have been made but for the fact that this is in the speech arena? I don't know. I believe in the antitrust laws. I tend to think that they work for good, but I'm very concerned about some of those thoughts of applying the antitrust laws in kind of a speech arena.
I'm very much against concentrations of power. Facebook doesn't worry me as much as Google, and my worry with Google is they have the number one search platform, they have the number one email platform, they are fairly dominant in something called Google Books. You know, there's several separate businesses that have spun off and separately would be major dominant players in a particular sphere of technology. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a good thing. At the same time, I remember, and some of us in this room probably remember when there was a desire to break up Microsoft because they were bundling the browser together with the operating system. And, you know, huge case. This is late Clinton administration. And, you know, I think technological innovation completely negated that case, or largely did.
Yeah, I think on exactly what Bill's getting at, I mean, I will stay agnostic on the antitrust issue because that is far from my wheelhouse, but I will say this, which is everything that looks unstoppable today, frequently in not too long a period of time, turns out to be very, very much stoppable.
You should send me an AOL IM about that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, I mean, MySpace was the game in town for a while, and then so where's MySpace now, right? So and
that's AOL.
And then my favorite example of this, and there are numerous others. My favorite example of this is in 2007, the year the first iPhone came out. There was like a cover, I think, of like Fortune magazine that was like Nokia, like can they be stopped? You know, the king of cell phones. And it's like that was the year the iPhone came out, and who has a Nokia phone anymore, right? So. And AOL is another perfect example of all of this. So, I mean, we shouldn't...
Send me a BlackBerry message.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
Do we have any other
questions in the audience?
Do you think that Justice Black's free speech absolutism is dead on the Supreme Court at this point?
I think that, no, I think it's probably emergent, actually. I think if you look at where Chief Justice Roberts, I think there's a very robust constituency for muscular First Amendment rulings, and I think we've seen that repeatedly over the tenure of the Roberts Court. And I think that actually crosses the typical ideological bounds. And not on everything. I mean, I think, you know, the Janus case is an exception, but I think on a lot of the doctrine, we're seeing very muscular First Amendment rulings.
I'm very sympathetic to the question. My law school mentor was very much a disciple or apostle of Justice Black. I think it's alive and well. I actually think there are three, maybe four justices who pretty much agree with it.
The sort of absolutist approach is ascendant, if by that we mean that, look, when something's either protected or it's not, and frankly, that's my approach to all constitutional rights. I think there's been Justice Thomas and others have written calling into question the whole framework of tiers of scrutiny and constitutional balancing, which is a completely modern 20th century invention. We didn't used to approach constitutional rights that way. I think there, like Bill was saying, I think there's several votes on the Supreme Court for the approach, not just to the First Amendment, but in general, that something's either protected or it's not protected. Now, there may be historical exceptions. We may look to history and tradition for like things like fraud or malpractice torts or things like that that were triggered by speech that have a long, long history in our Anglo-American system. But if it's protected, it's protected. And I think I think Justice Kennedy even wrote opinions saying that basically under his view, if it was protected, he would stop there and not do any more balancing. And obviously he's not on the court anymore, but I think there are other justices that certainly share that view.
Great, anyone else? Well, thank you all for being here and joining me in thanking our panelists again.